You are listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Ricky Bevington. A new book of short stories by David Sedaris includes his signature laugh-out-loud family antics. But in Calypso, the 61-year-old also contemplates his own aging body and the pain of watching his elderly father deteriorate. Sedaris joined me in the studio this week. I began by asking him if Calypso is his darkest book.
Gosh, I could see how people might think that, just because I have a sister who committed suicide a few years ago. And a couple of the essays, I talk about that. And so I think maybe that would lead people to believe that it's dark. I mean, I don't write about those things. You know, I try to get laughs when I'm writing about it. But, you know, when you're talking about somebody's suicide, you have to go a few paragraphs usually without, and be serious for a little tiny stretch.
You're known for going to dark places, but then bringing us back out with a funny joke or a light moment. Is there any personal or family trauma that is off limits in your writing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, there's a lot of things that I don't write about. Everybody has their secrets. You know, my brother used to love to be written about. And so I had a lot of things in this book that a couple of years he would have been fine with. And then he said, I don't want that in the book. So that's fine. I took it all out. I mean, I didn't ask him why. It doesn't really matter why. If he didn't want it in there, then I took it out.
Do you allow people whom you write about to review it before you publish it?
Oh, sure. Like, I have a story that I just sent to the New Yorker, and they're going to publish it, but I don't know when. But I wanted to get it to a certain state, and then my sister, Lisa, I'm going to see her tomorrow, so I'll give it to her tomorrow and ask her. It's hard for me to imagine there's anything in there that she would object to. I don't want to embarrass her.
I mean, you're naming people by name, right? So, obviously, if Lisa is in the book as Lisa, she should, I would hope, get a say in whether or not her words and stories make it into the book. So you have described your storytelling as real-ish. It's not journalism. It's not documentary. Your stories can be embellished, but they are based on real life. So, for example, did you really have a stranger cut out a tumor in the middle of the night?
Well, first of all, when you write for The New Yorker, every word of it is fact-checked. Everything. If I said that the weather, that it was a that I was in Atlanta, and then it started off cloudy that morning, and then the sun came out at noon, they would call, and if the sun came out at 11:45, they would say, no, you have to change that. In earlier books, I was freer, but as a humor writer, that's one of the tools you have in your box, right? I mean, if you're trying to get laughs from people. But the story you're talking about, a woman cut a tumor out of me and then sent it on ice so I could feed it to a turtle. Yeah, that happened. And I saw that woman about a month ago. She lives in El Paso, Texas, and we stayed in touch after she did that. And she's a doctor. She's not a surgeon. But she told me when she cut the tumor out, she said, you know, I took some surgery classes, but it's not really my thing. But if I open you up and it looks like it's more than I can handle, we'll sew you back up and send you on your way.
So she is a practicing doctor.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. It wasn't that just she took a few medical classes.
No. She took a few surgery classes, but she was a doctor. She just wasn't a surgeon. So, but then so many people came up to me and said, well, how do you know she was a doctor? But if someone tells me they're a doctor, I don't know. I don't see why I shouldn't believe them. I mean, if somebody approached me and didn't know who I was and say I was in the airport parking lot and somebody came up and said, I'm a doctor, can I operate on you? I might ask for some ID or something. But this is a situation where she was in the audience at a reading and I had mentioned on stage that I had already gone to a surgeon about this tumor and that he was offered to cut it out, but he said he wouldn't give it to me. So in that situation, I had no reason to distrust her. But also because I knew I would be writing about it, you know, I got her name and her address and her phone number because I thought, well, somebody's going to need to call her and I don't want to. I mean, sometimes you're writing about things you don't know you're going to be writing about them later. You're sitting next to someone on a plane or something, you know, and you don't think it would just be weird to say, can I have your name and phone number in case I ever write about what a horrible person you are.
So what do you say to people who really want to demand a very clear line between fiction and nonfiction?
Like I said, like writing for The New Yorker, I don't know. Like when I'm interviewed for a newspaper, a fact checker never calls me afterwards. You know, I had an article about myself in the New York Times. A fact checker never called me. I don't know what else I could do for people who want to have that discussion. I absolutely don't know what else I could do for them. You know, I feel like people get invested. Like if people don't believe something, they're invested in that. And then if you say to them, well, no, call this person. And they're like, yeah, right. Because they just refuse to say, oops, I'm wrong. And I'm sorry, but this is just a situation where, you know, there was somebody a few weeks ago, and then she said, well, how much of what you just read on stage is true? And I said, what did you doubt? And she couldn't name anything. But, like, I'm a professional. You know what I mean? Like, it's my job to write about things in a way, things that happen to me in a way that is going to get a laugh from people. And so, but I think sometimes people don't see the distinction, right? A lot of times people think, oh, that I just dictate my stories into a tape recorder or something. They don't understand that you chose this word over this word. And so maybe they don't quite see that. And they're thinking, well, I couldn't get a laugh out of that. So how come you are? And it's like, well, because I've been doing it for, I don't know, what, 40 years is why.
But you are embellishing aspects of the story.
Well, no, not really. I mean, I can't think of anything in that story that you're talking about, though having the tumor cut out of me. I can't think of a single thing in there that's embellished in any way.
She was really as tall as a child?
She was 5 feet tall. I mean, where do you draw the line of a child and an adult?
I ask because Americans today are debating truth versus lies in the news media from our elected officials. And I think that what we're getting to as a country at this moment is that deep desire not to be misled. I think that's a very deep human need, is to not feel betrayed or misled or be lied to, or all of the nuances. It's a spectrum, right?
But I find that to be really interesting, so that you hold the humorist's feet to the fire, but the politician who's in front of a crowd of tens of thousands of people and then is going on television, that's like, meh, you know, that's debatable whether that's, you know, that's true for some people and not true for others. But if you're writing about, you know, feeding your tumor to a snapping turtle, then it's like every single word of that must be true if it's going to be read in front of an audience of 2,000 people in Tucson, Arizona.
That's a good point. But we wouldn't be interesting subject matter for your books if humans weren't absolutely contradictory and self-defeating, right?
That's true.
So I'd like to ask you about how, as an author, you think about your audience. One example that I think about is J.K. Rowling, and she wrote her Harry Potter books to become more adult and mature, darker, scarier, more sexual, as her initial child audience grew up. It's like the protagonist actually aged with, I think, J.K. Rowling's core initial audience. Do you think of your audience as aging along with you and sharing that experience with you?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know. I feel like they're the same. They stay the same age. I get older, but they stay the same age.
It's I'm sure funny. They'd love to hear that.
You know, there are as many 9-year-olds in the audience now as there were 20 years ago. There is many really well-meaning lesbian couples in their mid-40s as there were 15 years ago. There is many, you know, organic gardening people in their 70s as there were. I just feel like, I don't know, they're just replaced. But I don't feel them getting older, just me, in a way.
Throughout your book, you reference paying for things. Why do you bring this up?
Paying for things?
For your family, specifically.
Oh, why do I mention that I'm the one who pays for stuff? I think I mention it with my family just because my dad is so cheap, right? If I'd go to Raleigh, my father would say, well, why don't we go out to dinner? And so I'll say, where do you want to go? And then he'll pick a really expensive place, and that's fine. And then he'll invite all these friends. And when the bill comes, he doesn't reach for his wallet. And I always feel like it's my job. You know, if whoever has the most money, it's their job to pay, right? But he puts me in these positions, and he just keeps adding to it and adding to it, and I'm the one to pay. So I do mention that, and I did buy my family a beach house. But that's important, you know, just because if you paid for it, then you get to, and if somebody, like, brings in a piece of furniture that you don't like, you get to say, like, actually, that goes under the house because you paid for the house.
Oh, you're flipping all the family power dynamics that you had as children, right?
Well, you know, I did this interview with Money Magazine a while ago. And it wouldn't have been my first choice. I've never picked up an issue of Money Magazine. But when I was talking to the guy, I thought, why have I never read a book about a money disorder? Because there's got to be such a thing. And I think I have a money disorder. I think my dad had a money disorder. I don't think my mother did. We meet a lot of people with, maybe just call it a financial disorder. I don't mean being poor. It's something else. Like if you said to me, I like your shirt, I would tell you how much it costs. Like as if you said to me, how much did that cost? And I don't know why I do that. But I think it comes from like I didn't have any money. And then I had more money than I ever imagined that I would. And I'm just sort of delighted by it. And I expect everyone to be as happy about it as I am.
As long as you get to pick out the furniture.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the name of your beach house?
Well, I bought a house on the coast of North Carolina. We would go there when I was a child. And so there all the names. At that point, you know, a house would be called Crab-a-dab-a-doo or Clam-a-lot. And now they have names like, there's a place near us called God's Place. Like, I'm sorry, you can't name your beach house God's Place. And then Dolphin Song. So our house had a dumb name, and so I changed it to the C-section.
And then S-E-A section.
Yeah, S-E-A section. But then we just bought the house next to us. And so we're going to call that either the Amniotic Shack or Canker Shores.
Is it up for a family vote?
I'll talk about it when we all get together. I had some names. We'd all come up with names. And then I was in a reading one night, and I said to the audience, I said, gosh, can anybody have any good ideas? And this one woman had both those ideas. And I've racked my brain. And she's just like a genius. She was just, and I came up with another name, and I made the mistake of saying it one night on stage, and the temperature of the room changed. And I realized, oh, it's always going to be too soon for that. Always. 1,000 years from now, it'll be too soon for that beach house name.
Well, that means you have to share it with
me. You know, I often chide myself because I feel like I never learn. But this is something I did learn. I couldn't erase it if I said it on the radio. It was bad enough to say it on the stage. And I knew I was, you know, you always think when it's leaving your mouth, you think, really? Anyway, never.
It's been focused grouped and denied.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you read a scene for me?
Sure.
I'll just set it up. It's a scene where you and your partner and your sister arrive. Do you call Hugh your partner?
I say boyfriend.
Your boyfriend. Okay. So this is a scene where you, your boyfriend, and your sister arrive at your 94-year-old father's house. You notice that it's a mess. He can well afford to move into a retirement home, but he won't spend the money. He won't even turn on the air conditioning or the lights. And you're disturbed, but you are trying to act normal.
I was just wondering what the house would look like had my mother been their surviving parent, when I noticed my father on the deck, just off his bedroom, staring into a tree. I'd last seen him a month earlier and had noticed how hunched over he was, not bent into the shape of a question mark, the way some people his age are, but still it made him look frailer. "Hey," he said as I opened the sliding glass door, "there you are." He wore white tennis shorts with a beige T-shirt and matching socks. Everything looked too big on him, his watch, his glasses, even his teeth, which is odd, as they're completely his own. When he stepped forward to hug me, I noticed 4 mean-looking bruises on his arm. They weren't purple, but black, and had cotton balls over them, held down with masking tape. "We brought you a cup of coffee," I said. "Fantastic." The living room is the last semi-presentable patch of territory in my father's house, the only one without a desk in it, so we retired there. "Gosh, you all look terrific," he said, taking a seat on the sofa. "So tan and healthy." "What happened to your arm?" I asked. "I fell," he told me, waving away my concern. "It happens sometimes when I turn around too quickly." "So you fall, and then what?" "I crawl around for a while, and till I come to a chair or something, and then I lift myself up. "Hey," he said to Amy, no doubt eager to change the subject, "I pulled out a few things I thought you might like." He gestured to a pile on the low table beside the sofa. "There's a straw hat that belonged to your mother and some pocketbooks." "I don't really wear hats," Amy told him. I didn't want my father to feel bad, so I picked it up. "The only bit that really says woman is the bow," I said, walking into the bathroom to try it on and noticing that both the sinks were filled with stuffed animals. It was like they had planned to take a bath and were just waiting for someone to turn the water on. What on earth, I thought. "I can't believe the straw is still in such good shape," I called into the other room.
Trying to keep it positive.
"Well, yeah. I mean, it's so odd to see a parent, you know, someone who was so powerful all your life. It's hard to see that person frail. You'd almost rather not be there so they wouldn't be embarrassed by their seeing it. And since that time, my father, he fell, and he was on the floor for like a day and before they found him. And so now he's at an assisted living place, and he's, you know, he just has a room there. And my father hates old people, hates them. And the people there are all younger than he is. Oh, and he mocks them and just detests them.
So are you saying that the only thing harder than watching yourself age is watching your parents get older?
Well, you know, my grandmother lived with us, and my father was an only child. My grandmother lived with us, and then my father put her in a home, right? There's no way my father's not thinking about that now, right? But you put your parent in a home. I think it's easier to imagine our death than it is to imagine our real, true decrepitude. But there's no way putting my father in this place, there's no way. You can't realize that in a blink of an eye, it will be my sisters and I in that place. It's going to feel like tomorrow to us. You just can't help but think of that. It's interesting, too, when you have a parent who's that old, you're still a child, you know? You're still somebody's child, but you're 61, and there's still someone who's going to call you son. Or you still have to, you know what it is? You still have to worry about Mother and Father's Day. Jesus. I mean, in the days of yore, you know, by the time you hit 30, you wouldn't be spending money on those holidays anymore.
Well, I think it's telling that as you're driving away from that scene, your boyfriend says, "Why don't you just pay for him to have a chauffeur or something, a driver?" And you say, there's some tension about whether or not you should be spending money on your father. And there's a lot of different reasons. You get into some of them. But I read that as, wait, he's the dad. He should be spending the money. It's weird. I don't want to supplant him. He's still alive. And somehow spending that money on him might be supplanting him in some way before his death.
Well, when my mother died in 1990, my father, I think he was thinking about, you know, there's an amount of money you can give away every year and you don't have to pay taxes on it or, you know. So we started giving people like pretty big checks at Christmas. And he said, I gave yours to Cindy and she put it in your account. Because he and I have the same banker, right? Every year I write my father a thank you letter and I say, thank you so much. I know you didn't have to do that. I so appreciate it. And then I talked to my banker a couple of years ago. She said, your father never put a dime in your account. He never put a dime in my account, but he received all the thank you letters all those years, and he never told me. And when I confronted him, he said, you don't need the money. And I was like, well, gee, you could have told me. You know, I would have, you know, saved the money on that international stamp. That's like $20 right there I could have made back.
In this same chapter, you visit a restaurant where your parents were eating in 1968. When someone in the restaurant announced the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., everyone in the restaurant burst into applause, except your parents, who had recently moved to the South. Why choose to end this book paralleling political divisions of 1968 with those that are dividing families and Americans today?
Gosh, I guess I didn't think of that. I mean, I wrote an essay in which that was a pivotal part of the essay, but it never worked out. And then when I was writing this essay, I was at that same restaurant. They have a branch at the airport. And I thought, oh, right, I might as well mention that. But I just mentioned it, I think, to show how Raleigh had, I'm not going to say changed, but just how it had grown. And I don't know, it was just still a part of, like, showing my dad when he was younger and then showing my dad when he was older. But I'd mentioned elsewhere in the book how, you know, that's affected my family, just like it's affected a lot of families. And my dad is so old, right? My father has always been a Republican, and nothing will change. If Adolf Hitler said, I have the nomination, my father would vote for Hitler for president. If Satan said, I will save you 17 cents on your taxes, my father would vote for Satan for president. And so I wrote to, like, because he's so old, you worry that every time I see him, I worry it's going to be the last time I'm going to see him. But you don't want to be fighting with him, right? So there's just so much we can't talk about. So when my father went to this assisted living center, I wrote him a letter. And he had wanted to move back home again. And I wrote and I said, it's not safe for you to be at home alone. That's not safe. I need you to live long enough to see Donald Trump impeached. Because that's what's going to happen. My father's going to die on a Wednesday, and Donald Trump's going to go down on a Friday. That's what it's bound to happen.
How did he respond?
I don't know. I sent it in a letter.
And he never wrote you back or mentioned it.
Well, I haven't really been. My father, I think he's written me like two letters in my life. He's not a big letter writer. He's not a big, and I haven't been home. I haven't been home. And I went on a 42-city lecture tour, 40 city in 42 days, and then went home for 3 days, and then I came back to start my book tour. But I might see him in a couple of days in North Carolina, and we can talk about it. No, we can't talk about it then. I'll just look in his room and see if the letter has been opened.
David Sedaris, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Ricky.
David Sedaris' new book is called Calypso.